Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Everyone, this is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something here on 94.7. And we air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. And we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're speaking with Lara Harrison, an organizer with Hate Free Schools Coalition of Albemarle County. They've been speaking out at school board meetings in an effort to ban all symbols of racial and ethnic hatred within the school system. We'll hear about what's really happening at the contentious school board meetings that have been making the news, as well as the alarming recent arrests. We'll hear about their new wins, not just here, but through other communities and at the legislative level, all toward abolishing racist imagery in schools. And we are speaking with legendary jazz trumpeter John Dirth. He is a composer, teacher, and the director of jazz performance at the University of Virginia. He teaches improvisation, jazz trumpet, jazz composition, and much more. He's a very, very cool guy, and it may be one of the most interesting conversations about music, life, and jazz you've ever heard. So welcome to this amazing show. Nancy, are you on the show right now? Are you there?
Ellen, I am here in the New York studios, but I do want to swing it back to Virginia.
Okay.
I have news of your state, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but apparently this year, in some parts of Virginia, it will be a crime to trick-or-treat if you're over 12 years old. You can actually go to jail for up to 6 months.
What?
And get fined 25 to up to 100 bucks if you're over 12. And if you're a parent or guardian, you are not permitted to wear a mask of any type.
Is this true? Is this real?
Would I fill the airwaves
no.
with
that
fake
is,
news?
That is just crazy.
This is a crime against Halloween.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I have 8 words, if I may change the subject, because I'm outraged. But in a very positive, hopefully, some positive vibes I want to send. My 8 words are, I heart Stacey Abrams. Please let her win in Georgia.
What's going on down there is unbelievable. That well, in several states, but especially Georgia, the whole
voting suppression,
disenfranchising people's vote, unbelievable.
I just saw an ad that her opponent is running, and this is what it says.
Yeah.
This is what he sounds like. This is verbatim, okay? Because would I put on the radio waves something that wasn't true? Okay. I got a big truck just in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take them home myself. Yep, I just said that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was I could have said that much more in a horrible voice. But anyway, it was more cartoonish.
No, and the guy is at the moment, anyway, it's part of the lawsuit, that he's in charge of certifying the election in which he is running.
Yes,
you cannot
exactly.
get more crooked than that.
Exactly. I mean, there's so much more, actually. The FBI knew that Russia was hacking into voting systems. I think it was in 2016. And they told him, your stuff is being hacked. And he said, I don't need your help. And then right after that, it may have been the same day, I heard that his state's election system was definitely hit by Russian hackers. I mean, his system was hit that day. I don't know. And he's holding 53,000 voter reg applications hostage in his office.
Right.
And most of them are African-American.
Right. 70% are black. Unbelievable. It's not unbelievable. It's just disgusting is what it is.
It is. And I want to say, so never again can we be asleep. And never again am I going to not pay attention, you know, to what's going on. And here is a number people can call. If there's any voter protection shenanigans going on, you can call 866-OUR-VOTE. And I called and it is a legitimate number and you can report any problems in any state. That's 866-OUR-VOTE, 687-8683.
Cool.
So did you know that Apropos of Something is a proud sponsor of a dance party in Charlottesville?
I am digging that. Please go on.
This coming Friday night, CIRAC, the immigration advocacy group that benefits immigrants, is going to have a dance party featuring food, DJ Dancing Cash Bar at the Kitchen in the Rose Hill neighborhood from 6 p.m. to 1 a.m. It'll be kid-friendly till 8. So there's more information on our webpage, 947wpvc.org.
I love it. I think that's excellent that we're part of that.
And then in Harrisonburg, there's an educator. We wanted to bring to attention one of our friends who's been on this program. They are helping to sponsor Amy Lewis, a music educator, who is going to be teaching restorative justice to challenge white supremacy in the classroom. And she's going to teach techniques, how to do that. It's open to everyone. It's free. This Thursday in Harrisonburg, October 18th at 7 p.m. in the Harrison School, Lucy F. Sims School.
Yeah, Steve Thomas from the Northeast Neighborhood Association of Harrisonburg.
Thank you. Thanks for
mentioning. Been on the show.
Yes.
He's part of that. Yeah, they're part of this.
Okay. So, we promised to get right to the show, so here we go. Laura Harrison is an organizer with Hate Free Schools Coalition of Albemarle County. As I said before, there have been very contentious school board meetings. Their mission is to ban all symbols of racial and ethnic hatred within the school system. So we're going to hear more about that and so many amazing things that they're doing. So welcome to the show, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking to you both today.
Great. So you're in the right place. So tell us what the, tell us what the mission is and what specifically led to the formation of this group.
Sure. So Hate Free Schools is really looking to create a culture of anti-racism in the school divisions. We want to shift the school board's mentality as well as the administrators to be proactive in dismantling racism in the schools rather than what has been the historical response of reacting to various incidents as they come up.
And what essentially do you want them to recognize? What is your goal in terms of changing things in school?
Sure. So we are looking at several different areas. We did focus on the Confederate flag and other racist imagery ban initially because we find that to be an acute issue and children are being traumatized by that daily. That's something that we feel like at baseline, we can get those intimidating racist images out of our schools. Our long-term goals include things like creating curriculum that is specifically anti-racist that would be implemented in the daily learning of our students. And in order to do that, first looking through the current curriculum to remove any whitewashed history and really teach students the accurate history of racism in this country.
So what led to the formation of this coalition? And I want you to lead us through, if you can briefly, the calendar year and what has happened at these school board meetings. So first, what led to the formation?
About 1 year ago, we were hearing from students, from our own children, that there was a need for kids to process what had happened on August 12th of 2017, and even children reaching out to their principals and being told these weren't discussions they could have at school because they were too divisive. So hearing things like that, having student athletes be told by their coach they should not take a knee during the anthem or they would be benched, and hearing from students at several of the high schools that they continuously see Confederate imagery on clothing and vehicles really led us to decide to take action.
You guys showed up in August, right? Sorry, that's
well before
happened.
August
it started falling apart.
Yeah. I'll back up a little bit. We actually started showing up in an organized way in January when we found that Lee Jackson Day was still printed on the school calendars, if you can believe that. And we pushed for that to be removed, and we were successful in doing that. Dr. Haas actually made a statement after our advocacy that he felt it was not in line with the division's values to keep that on the calendar, and it was removed from all future versions of the calendar in February of this year.
And so, then, you were going to say, I can tell, you were going to go on.
Yeah, we continued to show up to start to push them to create a overall ban on racist imagery. And we were invited to start meeting with some representatives. So school board member, the Office of Community Engagement, and Dr. Haas were some of the folks in that room. And for about 3 months in the late winter and early spring, a couple of us from Hate Free Schools were able to meet with them in what we were calling racism discussion groups and talk about broad ideas, like I mentioned, in terms of being actively anti-racist and how to make a school division look like that and how to talk about reviewing curriculum. And it was meant to be a long-term discussion group. And we decided to focus initially on the dress code ban.
And what did happen at that meeting in August 21st, which was when they, what happened in that first meeting, August 21st?
So when we had our third meeting with the representatives, the closed door meeting, so to speak, we had agreed upon a version of the dress code that included specific language banning Confederate and other white nationalist imagery. And it was quite a process. It wasn't easy. However, we had agreed upon that language, and then we found out that they were not going to move forward with that agreed upon version. So not only was it communicated to us by a person who wasn't part of the process, but it was done so by email. And there was a lot of trust that was broken in that situation. So we showed up. And we asked the school board not to vote on that version of the dress code because it did not include the specific language to ban Confederate and other racist imagery. And we did not feel like it did anything to protect our children. At that meeting, the school board agreed to not move it forward as an action item to vote on. So we felt like we had a success installing that process that day.
Then what happened?
We showed up to get arrested on the August 3rd. Yeah.
We showed up to the next meeting and we were shut down because during my public comment, some of the community members snapped their fingers. There was also a large police presence in the room that day, which is not common. And it was definitely in response to our large presence of community members. So we felt intimidated. They threatened police on us for snapping fingers, and they shut the meeting down. When they rescheduled that meeting, they did so without public comment. Mm-hmm. So again, we felt like they are really trying to squash any dissent from the community and parents.
And there were arrests, right? You yourself, am I right? You were arrested as well?
That's right. They scheduled the August 30th school board meeting, and they did not include a public comment. So we went ahead and scheduled with our group a town hall style meeting that we held outside the closed doors of Lane Auditorium, where they went on with business as usual. We had a beautiful group of folks there, students, parents, community members, teachers that were sharing public comment and singing and chanting. And it was really uplifting and affirming. And we got about 13 minutes into that town hall style meeting, and folks were being arrested without any warning for us to disperse. And while we were absolutely complying with police directives.
And all you were doing was carrying the same message, right? I mean, you were still just trying to get them to ban this racist imagery and the dress code, and not even it. Even I think you had like Confederate, as you said, Confederate symbols and Nazi symbols, and so you weren't doing anything differently. They just didn't want to hear from you anymore.
That's exactly right. We were being shut out of the discussion at that point.
And is their rationale something about the rationale they are telling you that they don't want to do what you're advising because they don't want to get sued for freedom of speech by a student that might want to wear something or other?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is a choice by the school division. It is totally within their legal abilities to ban Confederate imagery. It's been upheld in the Fourth Circuit, and you can reference cases Hardwick v. Hayward. Other schools in Virginia ban Confederate imagery. It is completely legal to do so. And the school board knows that. What they are doing is they are making a choice to avoid a potential legal lawsuit and a potential payout at the expense of children, particularly children of color. So they would rather have children of color continue to be exposed to these traumatic and intimidating images than to risk being sued by someone else.
So we're talking about the Albemarle County School Board. What is Charlottesville City Schools doing? What are they doing?
So they engaged with us about 3 to 4 days after those arrests at the August 30th meeting, and they invited us to the table immediately. We were very affirmed by them. They offered their support and their gratitude to the work that we were doing and immediately asked us to help them create a resolution that their board would publicly give then on, it was just last week, on October 4th, where they presented that for the first time, and they will be voting on that on November 1st. Their resolution strongly denounces racist Confederate imagery being in the school systems at all, and gives a very clear understanding of why that particular imagery is particularly traumatizing in the context of Charlottesville and the surrounding area.
Yeah, isn't there, like, the law about what to ban? Doesn't it include something like if it interferes, to your point, if it interferes with the educational message, then perhaps these things should not be allowed, which is what you're describing. I know we're preaching to each other, but that is what you're advocating for, right?
That's absolutely right. And one of the reasons why Albemarle County struggles to either admit or acknowledge that there is a material disruption to the learning environment is because they collect absolutely zero data on racist incidents in their school division, which we find appalling that that is not a practice that they engage in. But through our FOIA requests, we have found that they don't. They don't code anything as racist. And so there's no way to categorize those incidents and to look back at the data and say, how are things going in our school division? And we, in fact, are, collecting that data through the community members that we are in touch with, because we feel like if the school isn't going to set, be able to show that this is a culture of racism within ACPS, that we will do that.
We're gonna learn exactly how they're doing that after this break. Stick with us. We'll be right back. This is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Laura Harrison, an organizer with Hate Free Schools Coalition of Albemarle County. And in just a few moments, we'll talk with John Durth, the legendary jazz trumpeter. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to Ellen Daniels. That's me and Nancy Lawrence in New York City, and our very special guest, Laura Harrison, with Hate Free Schools Coalition of Albemarle County. So before the break, Laura, you were just alluding to one of the really great ways that you're combating the system by collecting data. Tell us about that.
That's right. So we found through our FOIA requests that Albemarle County does not collect their own data on racist incidents. And in order for us to be able to show strong and solidly that there is a continuous culture of racism, we've created a anonymous way for folks to share incidents that have occurred while they were students, teachers, things that they have witnessed in the Albemarle County School Division that were racist incidents.
How did you communicate, since it's, you're saying it's not, you didn't say it's secret, what was the word you used for it, sorry?
It's anonymous. Folks do not have to share identifying.
How did you make it aware to, how do you do that? How do you communicate with everyone?
Yeah, well, that's ongoing. In fact, we continuously share it through our social media outlets and just through word of mouth.
So it sounds like you don't want to say it right now, which is fine. Is that true?
I can actually put it up on the website after.
Okay.
I can give it to you to
can
put
I
on the
say
website.
The mechanism? Because it's so mysterious.
It's a Google form.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you say that? It's a Google form. So I think that's great that you're taking matter into your own hands. Clearly, that's what's needed.
It's ironic to me that the attorney, the Commonwealth attorney, I guess, is the name for the man, at least the one I've been reading about, how he's penalizing you guys for your right of free expression, but clearly doesn't see the disconnect with these very hateful symbols that people, you know, some kids want to wear. Isn't that he's telling you one thing and telling them the other?
That's right. And that does highlight something that is very relevant to Charlottesville and the surrounding area right now, that over 60 anti-racist activists have been arrested since early 2017 when we started to see the white supremacists show up in our communities. And when you compare that to the number of white supremacists who are facing any charges, it's much higher. So we are being penalized for wanting to be anti-racist, wanting to stand up in our communities and in our schools. And that's been made very clear by Robert Tracy, the Commonwealth's attorney in Albemarle County, that he values civility.
I've heard that other communities are reaching out. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Certainly. So not only did Charlottesville City Schools engage with us, which led to their resolution and led to us also meeting with some of the state legislators, we've also been contacted by private schools asking us for guidance on how to change their policies around this type of imagery. We've also been contacted by other school division representatives who want to take our documentation and our process and address it with their boards. And then we've also just seen in the last couple of days, Stanton Action Group was able to successfully have a vote 4-2 to change the name of their high school, which was formerly R.E. Lee High School.
So that's so great. Just
that's
Monday.
A huge win.
Yeah, that is amazing. And some legislative stuff you guys are doing, I believe. Were you able to meet with some people from the Virginia Assembly?
That's right. Charlottesville City Schools invited us to that meeting. Interestingly, ACPS did not invite us to theirs. But we were able to sit down and have sort of an open roundtable discussion with Cray Deeds and Dave Toscano about this issue. And some of the things that came out of that meeting, one thing in particular was that they strongly stated there is no reason why the school divisions cannot ban these images. It's a school to school on a case-by-case basis. They legally absolutely can do so. What we are asking is to push for legislation that strongly supports removing symbols of hate from all public spaces. And that was really the conversation started on that day. And that's something that we feel like Hate-Free Schools is doing, is really pushing this conversation to be out in the public more, out in the community more, something that folks weren't talking about as publicly. And I say that with all acknowledgement to the parents, and particularly parents of color, who have been having to advocate in this way since forever, long before Hate-Free Schools was an organized coalition, and not always having their voices heard. And so we always want to acknowledge those parents and thank them for the work they've done long before us.
Yeah, it's amazing that it's so similar to any other issue right now, in that, like, Congress won't do it, so all the states have to do, whether it's, pollution or voting. Everything's piecemeal, and it sounds similar. Like, you cannot get the big picture to make the statement. You have to now, not that what you're doing isn't so important, but how nice would it be if you had, like, this loud voice, we won't accept this, but yet now you have to, like, piecemeal yourselves to get individual schools to just do the right thing.
That's right. That's right. And we find it very ironic that some of the schools who have banned Confederate imagery, particularly Orange County, North Carolina, where our sister organization, Hate-Free Schools, exists, they had worked with their school board for many, many months. And the day after August 12, 2017, here in Charlottesville, they unanimously voted to ban Confederate imagery because of what happened here. And so it's very sad to me that we had that happen in our community and we can't address it in the way that is needed, strong and bold ban on Confederate imagery here.
So what are the chances of voting these people off the board?
They're great.
Good.
That's what we saw with Stanton Action. They worked. It took about 2 years, and you know that's sort of the cycle of elections too. Some folks are up for re-election next year, but we have a group of folks that's working on a flip the board campaign that will be starting to do some work around canvassing. There, we have a couple candidates who are interested in running. And we have a lot of experience in our coalition and supporters in running for school board and running campaigns, and a lot of people who are really excited. And our goal is to get all anti-racists on those school board seats.
That is such a, obviously, that is such a great idea, because you just reminded me when I was reading about what you guys were doing that one of the board members at one of your meetings, he was wearing a Confederate flag tie. Right? I don't know where you were. You guys were probably sitting somewhere differently, but apparently he wore a necktie featuring all these historic Confederate flags, claiming it was, you know, just a piece of history, you know, and what's wrong?
That's right. That's right. He wore the tie on the day that we were there to talk about banning Confederate imagery. And yes, Jason Bujaki is one of the seats that we are determined to flip to an anti-racist school board member.
I cannot wait to vote for that, because
yes.
I live in that county.
Yes.
Yes.
And were they the ones, or was it worked out with you guys that they there's like a student board that they want to explore this issue? Is that from them or is that from you guys?
That's a great question. When we were in our racism discussion groups with the representatives from ACPS, one of the things that we brought up initially was an overarching anti-racism, anti-racial harassment policy, just like we have sexual harassment policies in schools. And we brought that to the table as an idea, and we, you know, kind of focused and honed in on the dress code to begin with. That that student panel was created while we were working with the racism discussion group, but no one told us about it. And so there was a lot of things along the way that ACPS did where we felt like there was a lot of gatekeeping and there was a lot of trying to keep us out of the process and not being transparent, when some of those things we actually would be in support of and in line with, including that student panel.
But they're making it, or at the moment anyway, what you're saying is that you're wondering if it's like possibly window dressing, just to say, well, we're listening, but how would you know if you're not being allowed access? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. They are definitely in a scramble to look good in the media right now because of the things that occurred on August 30th. There was a large activation, I would say, of support for hate-free schools, and a lot of folks who know how those brutal and unjust arrests occurred, you know, became vocally outraged against ACPS. So there's been this PR scramble we've been seeing, and some of it is frankly, you know, it's unacceptable what we have heard from both Kate Acuff, who is the chair of the school board, and Dr. Haas, who is the superintendent, who said things in the media such as hate-free schools are outside agitators, that we had bussed individuals in for those meetings, and you know, Dr. Haas thanking the police for protecting the school board after those arrests, when in fact we are not threatening, we are not violent, we were not in any way a threat, and that narrative is just really detrimental to what we're trying to do. Kate Acuff also stating that racist incidents have gone down since August 12th, which is a very irresponsible and dishonest thing to say when we have no data. So how could you claim that?
Mm-hmm. And I think you issued a press release about that. So I think it's okay to talk about some of the details because I know it's an ongoing situation. But mm-hmm. And from what I heard, I didn't see it myself, but there was video of that I would call it a very nonviolent gathering where certain members were or leaders were targeted, I believe, and then just for sitting down, doing nothing, were thrown to the ground pretty violently, and one of the people at least had to go to the ER as a result. I mean, I just want people to know about that.
Yeah. One of our community members who's a parent and teaches in the city schools, he came that night in support of what we were doing, and he was brutalized by the police, and he is now facing felony charges, felony assault charges, when he was actually the victim of brutality and had to be treated at the hospital that night. So we are, you know, devastated. We're angry and we're sad that that's happening to Mike, and we are rallying behind him. We are hoping folks will show up to support him in court on October 16th at 9 a.m. That information is on our social media. And, you know, just sit quietly in the courtroom and show that we are there in solidarity mm-hmm. and continue to support Mike and his family, because this is a pretty scary time to be targeted in the way that he's being targeted.
Absolutely. And I know you're on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle is at HateFreeACPS. Facebook, you just search Hate Free Coalition of Albemarle County. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, because we have got this sort of media portrayal of, you know, being agitators, that what we're really doing with Hate Free Schools is we're really trying to create a loving community of anti-racists. We want parents, community members, and teachers to be gathering and building community and sharing ideas. We want to support teachers in the schools so they can feel like they are able to teach what they want to teach and build children up to be anti-racist community members. A couple things that we have done so far. Last night, we just partnered with Hold the Line magazine and filled 130 people in the local cinema to see the movie The Hate U Give for free. So we helped raise money for that and then get kids there to see that movie. And there was a beautiful discussion afterwards. We've had a community potluck, and we have also done things with other groups in the community. One such event that I do want to name that's coming up soon is this Hate Free Schools and Hate Free Spaces co-sponsored event. It is an educational opportunity, and Professor Jelaine Schmidt is going to be doing a statue tour on October 20th. It'll start at 8:30 a.m. She's going to do a tour of the statues and talk about local history. And then there will be a 10 a.m. panel discussion at the downtown library. And you're going to get some really amazing and brilliant activists on that panel. People that are local, people that have done things in this community. And one in particular shout out I want to give is to Ziana Bryant, who is a student activist that began the petition to remove the Confederate statues. She will be on that panel, and so it's definitely not to be missed. That's October 20th. It starts at 8:30 a.m., and you can follow our page for the event details. They'll be posted there soon.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Laura Harrison.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for
all. It's been a pleasure.
Good. And come back with an update, hopefully really good news, as you keep going with your successes. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Hey, Nance, how you doing? Do we have time for a news of note?
I'm going to bow out of mine, knowing that I can see a clock from my computer.
I know.
I leave that to you.
Well, Wow, it's so gracious of you to do that, and now I'm left with trying to decide on the spot. Well, I just wanted to talk about a woman in Charlottesville named Maria Chavalan, who came from Guatemala, who was being persecuted there, sought asylum because of a very silly mix-up. The U.S. immigration asked her to leave, and she is taking sanctuary in the Wesley Memorial United Methodist Church here, where I have spent quite a lot of time in my commute to work. So she said that it's for the first time she can breathe, it's for the first time she can sleep, and she has not felt afraid. And there is quite an organization around her called Hands Off Maria, if you want to help with supplies and helping her case. And they're trying to get her day in court so that she's allowed to stay here. She has four children. So I just wanted to mention that is going on.
Yeah, that sounds sad and uplifting at the same time.
Yeah, so we hope for her case. So we're going to go to a hard break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk with John Durth. So stick with us, everybody. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning, and we're here with John Durth. He is a household name in this town. He's a heavyweight in the music arena. He's played with great players like himself. He is, of course, a jazz trumpeter and a composer. He's also the director of jazz performance at the University of Virginia, where he teaches improvisation, jazz trumpet, jazz composition, and he also directs the UVA Jazz Ensemble. He plays in combos, duos, quintets, septets, or solo, wherever he can. We are so honored to have John with us. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks for having me, you guys. Really appreciate it.
We're doing it solo today. I hope that's
that's fine.
Actually, we're a trio.
Yeah, we're a trio, or even
Wait,
a quartet.
No, I'm so sorry.
In a way, just listening to Laura talk, it's so relevant and germane to everything I'm thinking these days musically, so I was blown away by that interview. Thank you.
Yeah, well, tell us what you mean by that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's embarrassing a little bit to even talk about music from the point of view of how much, you know, joy and pleasure you get from it after hearing an interview like the one we just heard, where people are struggling and dealing with issues that should have been put to rest so long ago. But really, you know, I mean, I have to put it right out there now, when, especially since the events of two summers ago in Charlottesville, that here I sit, a white guy playing black music, and this is jazz is black music, end of story, as Dave Liebman said. It's a great gift that was created in this country out of the actual experience of black people in this country. So I say this music is the music of black America more than I would say it's African American. And so I want to say that, you know, I think in this way about music, from my own experience, I grew up with this music and I just happened to be exposed to it in a very brilliant way. So I was very well versed in black music, and what I realize now is music is neurological. It goes from and to your nervous system. And jazz music and the blues and gospel music, what was created in this country by black people, was recorded, went around the world, and those who had ears to hear were changed by it. And there are great jazz musicians in every corner of the globe now who are every color you could imagine, and where every note we play is Black Lives Matter, because Black Lives created these notes that we play. So it's a huge feedback loop, and it becomes a little more. I never used to want to be a proselytizer for jazz music, like, oh, you should love jazz music. So many young people of any color today are not super hip to jazz. They think of hip hop more and don't see the connection necessarily, although it's a huge straight line back to the blues, back to early black music. But anyway, now I feel much more interested in talking about the jazz experience in this country, because it mirrors the whole racial history of the country. We have these musicians like, you know, just to, you start mentioning their names, you could just spend the whole 20 minutes that we're going to talk just reciting names of people like Miles Davis, Wayne Shorter, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Billie Holiday, Bessie Smith. I mean, you could just not stop. And these people, many of them are on every level with a Nobel Prize winning, you know, writer like Hemingway or Faulkner. But what do we know? This music is much more respected and understood in other places. So it's a beautiful mirror image lens for the actual systemic racism in this country.
Well, since you are performing everywhere, I mean, we haven't, obviously, we just started speaking, but since you are performing everywhere with everyone, are you noticing any differences with, and I don't even know what I'm really asking you to, anyway, are you noticing any differences with your audiences in the last year or so, their reactions, the things you hear from them?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because musicians are hip to this already. Every jazz musician knows this systemic racism chapter and verse. The first integrated jazz band was done by Benny Goodman, who was called the King of Swing. And in fact, it was, you know, the whole story of jazz is the story of commercialism versus art, appropriation. You know, Benny Goodman, I'm sure, was pleased to be called the King of Swing. He was a great, great musician and band leader, but he was not the King of Swing in actual swing. And what is swing? Louis Armstrong said it best. If I have to explain it, you'll never understand anyway. But it was Benny Goodman who integrated jazz, and they told him, well, you'll never work in the South. And he said, well, then we won't, because he wanted Charlie Christian, Teddy Wilson, and Lionel Hampton in his band, and changed history with that music.
So what does jazz teach us? I mean, you're already talking about one huge topic, and I feel like there's other areas as well.
Well, musically, it teaches something huge. And actually, we need a big music lesson in this world. That's sort of my evangelical, you know, point of view at this point. People are musical in the same way that they're sexual or that they have any biology. Okay? It's biological. But we put music above us, because we do this triage with people, because we're very critical of music, because it's so powerful. So if a kid doesn't sing perfectly in tune, they get to hear about that. How many parents have said, oh, don't sing, sweetie, or teachers, don't sing? It's a crime against nature to not include people in a musical experience. Now, musicians are above us. We put music above us. It's not. It's part of us. But musicians are above us. Bach is above us, and Charlie Parker and Jimi Hendrix are above us, and we aspire to that. We're inspired by that. But everybody's got music inside, and if people were more musical systemically, to use that word again, they'd have a much easier time talking to each other. Because what jazz has to teach, that's a good question, and this is why I'm really teaching it more specifically than I was before. Jazz teaches two things. Jazz gave music back to the musicians, if you will. It took music out of the hands of the elite composer and put it back into the hands of the musicians who were going to create this music themselves. In order to do that, you have to own musical language on your instrument. You have to be so rigorous and vigorous and fluent with musical language, because jazz is based a lot on what we call improvisation, but improvisation is not making it up, because we're improvising right now having a conversation. Improvisation is talking in music, and you have to know the vocabulary. So that's for us Westerners. It is intervals, the distance between two notes, chords, and scales. And we learn this on our instruments, and jazz musicians master this to a degree that most people, and even in the classical world, admit it's jazz musicians who really know their instruments inside and out. The other thing jazz teaches is be yourself. Don't imitate. Tell your own story. And those are the two lessons.
You just reminded me, because you do teach, I know, at the university, but you also have classes or a conservatory orchestra for kids, right? For early development.
Well, you're talking about something that started a few years ago that I did actually formally have for a couple of years on a Saturday morning, the Precognitive Conservatory Orchestra. which was musicians first who had never touched or played instruments before got together and played free music. But we finally found we couldn't ban the kids who had been studying instruments. They wanted to do it too. So we had everybody. But the reason this started was because I got involved with some kids on a Saturday morning, and one of these boys was in a piece that I wrote for the, which we're going to actually perform again on October 18th. For the whole fourth grade of this area, 1,600 fourth graders are going to come to Old Cabell Hall and hear this piece. It's a symphonic, it's sort of a jazz Peter and the Wolf. It's called Ben's Jazz Trumpet. It's based on a story by Rachel Isadora called Ben's Trumpet. And it's a story of a little kid, a young black kid who is hearing the sounds of jazz from the local club and plays along with his air trumpet. And then his friends laugh at him because he doesn't have a real trumpet. And then he gets a real trumpet. So it's a kind of jazz Peter and the Wolf to learn the instruments in the jazz band, the piano, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So,
but anyway, my point was I was hanging with this kid who was acting out the role of the boy when we did this years ago. And I took two kids into my studio one morning. I didn't want to make hanging out with them too much like school. But I took them in my studio, and I said, I'm going to give you guys a music lesson, an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old, Noah Ivory and Justin Kennedy. And without a word, they went to the piano and to the drums and started playing this music together. And they'd never touched the instruments before, and it was totally coherent to me. I'm saying coherent. I didn't. You know, they didn't have chops. Their tempo was not together. They got mad at each other about trying to stay. But they obviously knew what they were trying to do. And for once, I didn't talk too much to them. I just picked up my horn and started playing with them. And I learned a huge thing there, which is that these kids could already do it. They didn't need it explained to them. You know, education to lead out is what it means. You know, the Latin root of educate is to lead out. You already know. This is so true in music more than almost any other thing. Mm. And so by me being able to play coherently with them, it told them somewhere, what we're doing is right. He's playing with us. We're fine. These kids don't have concentration in school. You know, they don't pay attention. They punched a teacher. We played for 20 minutes, and then, okay, let's go eat. I mean, it was, it transformed my life. So I started this group.
That's fantastic. There is a TED Talk you do with kids that if people want to see that
those
in action.
Those are those kids.
Those kids. It is amazing.
They're very scared on the TED Talk, but afterwards they jammed out, and it was so good. I wish somebody had filmed that, but anyway.
Well, it looked pretty good what I saw.
Thank you.
And just like the jazz, you know, the things that seem so complicated, you know, when you think about learning jazz. So how do you teach improvisation?
Well, first thing you do is you say improvisation is talking in music, and you teach that in order to talk with your friends the way you do and have these successful improvisations, you have to have unconscious competence in language. You know, you go through, a friend of mine taught me this, his music teacher, his trumpet teacher told him this, 4 stages of learning to learn how to talk. Unconscious incompetence, conscious incompetence, then conscious competence, and finally unconscious competence. Where we are talking, we're not thinking of any rules or how to do this or what the spatial relation should be between myself and the other person or what. Nothing. We're thinking nothing. And we're totally breaking the rules to better effect. How do you get there? You have to become fluent in vocabulary. And this happens very naturally when you're a kid. With a musician, you have to realize, I've already got this. It's not some magical thing that I have to learn how to do. I can already do this with one note. And, you know, jazz again. Miles Davis, of all people, taught us the value of one note. He played so few notes sometimes. And he said, I want to teach my notes the same lessons I want to teach my children. How to stand up for themselves and why they're there.
Wow.
So that's jazz.
Go ahead.
Okay, John, you know, you've collaborated with some grown-ups as well, quite
a few.
So I have a two-parter for you. You don't have to give us everything, but just a few for people who don't know your legacy, who you've collaborated with, and also my follow-up to that, sir, is how, if you can, how are you able to be a part of so many different genres? So there.
Coffee.
Okay.
Oh, man after my own heart.
No. Well, you know, I don't know about what to say about that. I mean, the thing that anybody in my position will say, and when I say my position, I mean somebody who has been able to make a life out of music that they love to do. And every musician who makes a living in music probably does three things in one form or another: play music, teach music, and write music. So we all do that. I've been lucky from the beginning. I mean, possibly it was my parents who were a mess in many ways, but really encouraged following your heart, listening to the music, let the music tell you what to do, is what my father would say to me. And I was lucky to just meet great musicians all my life and be able to play with them, and musicians help each other. Music is a social art. I mean, my resume says I played with Miles Davis. That's probably the most famous name on my resume, but I just happened to be in a big band playing at the Montreux Jazz Festival, and suddenly Quincy Jones basically commandeered our spot, brought in another big band, Gil Evans Orchestra, so that Miles could recreate these things he said he would never do. And we were all there, part of it, and it was just the most astonishing, amazing thing for, you know, 38 hours to be with Miles. Wow. 6 weeks before he died.
That's amazing. Speaking of Miles, tell us, I've heard you talk about the posture of a student and what Miles has said. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, you told me I couldn't swear on the air, though.
You can't swear.
Okay, well, I'll just make it simple. But I wrote an opera about this. It's called Sacred Profanity, and you know, Nietzsche predicted this long ago, when, beyond good and evil, when he says, what's good, what's evil, depends on who you ask. Ask the slaves what's good, it's bad for the masters. Ask the masters what's good, it's bad for the slaves. He kind of prefigures Ebonics in that, because musicians say what's good is bad. They say, that is bad. Mm-hmm. Bad is something bad that you don't want to say on the air. Mm-hmm. Bad is that. Or you call another musician you love by the most horrible name, or by the name of a female dog, and that's the highest compliment. That's sacred profanity. But what was the question you were saying?
The defensive posture of
students. Yeah, I say this to my students all the time. I say, it's the basic posture of a student to be defensive, and we're all students. You know, all I got to do is put on a Miles Davis record or a Clifford Brown record, and I'm a student. We're all the same. So what's the posture of a student? To show your strength and sweep your weaknesses under the rug, okay? Obviously, defeat that default so that you can learn something and have good humor about being an imperfect person, because here's what artists do. They are unapologetic and simply give it to you, warts and all, and say, this is it, deal with it. And in my opera, I use a quote by Miles Davis from Miles's autobiography, where he says, more great music and great musicians have been lost through the ignorance of critics and through the musicians themselves not being strong in the ability, as I am, to say, and then you can't say it on the air.
But he did say, so what?
So what, instead of what I was just about to say.
Mm-hmm.
An ability to say, F y'all, that's it. And that is precious information for all of us.
Yes.
What you're saying. I'm pointing to Laura over here.
Yeah, I mean, as you said.
Come on now.
As you said, tell your story and don't copy people.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So when you're in a studio, I'm just curious, because this is jazz, are you analog? Are you digital? What's going on in there when you're making music?
Well, it's always different in every situation. But listen, I'll tell you, I'll point you to something so awesome that isn't about me. And it's a boxed set that you can now get on Miles Davis, where they give you 14 minutes of rehearsing in the studio to lead up to an iconic recording of a song that they couldn't play when they started rehearsing it 14 minutes before they recorded it. And if you want to know what happens in the studio, just listen to that and how they curse and say, I can't do this. What do you mean you want me to do this? You mean like Elvin? Says Tony Williams, the drummer. It's hilarious. And then there's a moment on there where Miles will come out with these ideas that are just Miles. Like, for example, on the song Nefertiti, he says, hey, let's not solo on this tune. Let's just play the melody over and over again, which was such a huge innovation and iconoclastic thing to do on his record Nefertiti. And the other guys in the band, when he suggests this, they're all younger guys, you just see him laughing, and you hear him laughing and shaking their heads and going, only Miles would come up with something like that. Why didn't I think of that? Anyway, does that help?
Yeah, that's so fantastic. So, I don't know, we're kind
where
of coming...
Can people see you? Are you still doing those Thursday nights at Miller's?
Yeah, that's crazy. It's okay. Like the Portrait of Dorian Gray there at Miller's. Nobody knows how long that gig's been going on, but I...
Yeah, 35 years?
Yeah, we have people there who were not born, who are doing the gig now, mm-hmm. who weren't born when we started doing
Amazing.
That gig.
Amazing. What time can we catch you there?
10:30 plus
wow,
on a
nice.
Thursday night.
It's so
two
jazzy.
Sets. It's two killing sets of jazz. And one thing that you see, and Miller's has two great jazz nights. Wednesday night, the Jeff Decker, Mike Rosinski quartet, which is kind of more straight ahead quartet. But we tend to be more freewheeling. It's a bigger family of musicians, and we encourage people to sit in with us. So a lot happens up there.
Really? Wow. Okay. Well, I'd love to check that out again. Thank you so much for being here. I only am sorry that we've run out of time.
Can I plug one thing?
Oh, please.
October 20th, come see the Freebridge Quintet, which is the faculty jazz quintet at the University of Virginia, in Old Cabell Hall at 8 o'clock for our concert, Living Legend, the Music of Sonny Rollins.
Oh, Sonny Rollins. I know the name. Thanks. Will you play us out?
No, you must hate our music. I was just thinking that, actually.
No.
I loved your music, and I'm not kidding, and I asked Ellen, what is that music? That's both musics.
You mean the Indian music?
The Indian music, but then your music came
good.
On. That was awesome.
Cool.
No, I thought it was beautiful.
You're so gracious.
I like music.
Yeah.
I like to teach jazz to people who are never going to play jazz.
Wow. Well,
singer-songwriters.
I feel so inspired from both of our guests, Laura Harrison, Hate Free Schools Coalition of Albemarle County, and John Durth, of course, the jazz trumpeter.
Thank you.
We'd be very honored if you ever wanted to come back, either of you.
Thank you so much.
Well, just let me know, and I'll come back with her anytime, and her husband, who we share this love for, Damani Harrison.
Oh, fantastic.
<I do. laughs>
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, again. Our theme music is Springtide. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. And thank you so much, Nance.
Oh, Alan, thank you as well.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, you guys are...
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.